My name is Diana Shepherd, and I'm the editorial director of Divorce Magazine and a facilitator here at the Divorce School. Today's topic is entitled Divorce and the High Net Worth Client, Issues and Opportunities. And my guest is certified divorce financial analyst, Verilyn Morris. Working as a financial professional for more than 30 years, Verilyn knows the impact divorce can have on finances. She is qualified as an expert witness, so she has seen how these kinds of divorces play out in court. Welcome, Verilyn.
Oh, thank you, Diana, for having me. It's great to be involved in the Divorce School.
Let's get right to the questions. Verilyn, you often work with high net worth clients in your divorce practice. What is your definition of high net worth? I'm also wondering whether the definition might vary a bit by region. I expect in some areas you could live like royalty on $100,000 a year. In others, you'd need to triple that to live well. So what is your definition?
Well, it would depend on the area. We practice in Frederick, Maryland, which is a very small community. It is a downtown city, but a much smaller city. Where we are located also is between the Baltimore and Washington, D.C. area. So what you would find, for example, in Frederick, Maryland, is that those can live on $100,000 a year quite comfortably and also can be considered high net worth due to the fact that many of the individuals here in Frederick may be county or city employees. They have been steady as she goes, if you will, and have accumulated significant net worth through diligent contributions to 401ks, the pension plans that are still offered in our area, where otherwise in the Washington, D.C. area, we would consider a high net worth client that would be upwards from $300,000 to $500,000 in income and probably have about $5 million in assets. That is not uncommon. You'd find the same thing in Baltimore.
Obviously, spouses who come from wealthy families or those who own lucrative businesses are considered high net worth clients. But what other kinds of clients might be considered high net worth?
Well, you know, this is a classification that is primarily used in the financial services industry. And really, there's no clear definition. A high net worth client might be someone who makes typically, as I said before, more than $500,000 a year with a net worth of probably over $5 million. This network would be considered a sub-high net worth client. Those who are new to the high net worth club, for example, would be those with $1 million in assets. They would be considered affluent. Some of the higher net worth clients, the affluent at the upper end, would be those, again, who are making more than $500,000 a year and may have upwards up to $50 million in assets.
You bring significant experience in the financial planning area to your divorce work. Can you give us an example of how a client could benefit from working with a financial professional with your experience?
That's a great question. Experience is the key word here. In my career, it's expanded over 35 years. I have worked in the area of pension plans, actually developed them with plan administrators when they were in vogue. I have worked with large companies in developing their 401ks, so I understand the mechanics of that. There are also other financial products that we've worked with. Many of them would be something as simple as a life insurance policy, but because of its inherent features, they could be designed to provide retirement income as well as to keep a company from the loss of a key person, or even to buy out stock. So some of these employees that are in these types of plans have reporting that is not so apparent. For example, with what I just mentioned in a life policy, the assets grow on a tax-deferred basis. So the reporting, again, is limited. The executive, however, receives a 1099 based on the economic value of the life insurance face amount on its own. And the economic value would be determined by the Table 1 rates, which is what we call the PS58 rate. So therefore, you can't really tell, and we must uncover those specific employee handcuffs or deferred compensation plans, much more deeply, because the actual value, which would be the cash accumulation, is much more significant than what would be actually reported.
What are the special considerations or challenges that high net worth clients might face during divorce?
One that is typical, and something that we often see, are family-owned businesses. They typically have significant assets within the company that must be preserved. And there's often quite a lot of value in each individual's specific contributions and specialties in that business. We also find that non-family partnerships, many will share jointly and shared retirement plans, namely IRAs, 401ks, pensions, stock options, trusts, real estate holdings, and other properties. As I mentioned before, Diana, golden handcuffs, such as deferred compensation plans, and even executive benefits, such as travel, they have a worth, and much of that is considered marital property.
Verilyn, your firm often utilizes a team approach, especially when working with high net worth clients. What professionals would you include on your team for a financially complex divorce?
Well, because most divorces have to do with the division of the marital assets, therefore property, we use certified public accountants, for example. We can uncover many assets that might be involved by just looking at the various schedules. For example, if Schedule E would show rental income, if an alternative minimum tax might be applied, that shows that there would be many deductions that would be limited because of an individual's high salary. We can also uncover multiple flow-through businesses, for example, like partnership or ownership in a sub-S corporation on Schedule E as well. We also look at specialized lawyers, particularly the client's own lawyers. One may be their estate planning attorney and another perhaps their corporate attorney. An investment advisor is often utilized, as well as the client's financial planner. And then what's important and sometimes unusual might be appraisers. You may have collectibles. You may have a collection of something that's unique, the appraisal of art, for example. And then very important when there is a business involved would be a business valuation specialist. We find that having that valuation in a business prior to any type of divorce sets the value. It may need to be adjusted as time goes on, but much better to value than, of course, having, for example, the IRS come and value a business where, of course, the valuation would be pegged higher.
Can you tell us briefly what is the difference between marital and separate property in divorce?
Marital and separate property is often major concerns. What is marital and what is separate? That can sometimes get muddy. Marital property is property acquired during the marriage, and separate property would be property that would be acquired prior to the marriage, for example. However, there needs to be caution that's exercised. For example, inheritance. An inheritance would be considered separate property. However, if any inheritance goes into a joint bank account, why then it would be considered marital. Another is from separate property. At the date of the marriage, the growth of the interest that's accrued would sometimes be considered marital property. And often our suggestion is to open a separate account to deposit any interest or any growth of what might be from separate property so that we do not have any commingling and that we can identify what would be marital.
Verilyn, when you're reviewing the proposed division of marital assets, what are some of the most common mistakes that you've seen?
What we see often are one of the parties who may consider the short term as opposed to the long term. You know, in the short term, sometimes one party may want to keep the marital home, but they may not have the sufficient assets or the sufficient cash flow in order to maintain the home. But taxes, we see taxes are a very, very big concern. When we look at the division of property, we take into account the taxable and non-taxable assets. For example, the marital home. if one spouse wants the marital home and they go to sell that home, you have exclusions where for each individual, you have a $250,000 exclusion. And for a couple, you have $500,000. Selling that property would be a tax-free situation. Whereas those that would choose retirement assets, for example, those will eventually become taxable. Another might be the division of a brokerage account, for example. You must be very, very careful. You may have a stock that was purchased at $5 a share and the same stock purchased at $10 a share. So you would have a much different situation in terms of taxation.
If one spouse inherits significant money or property during the marriage, what can be done to preserve it in the event of divorce?
Definitely keep it separate. Never commingle those funds into a joint account because therefore the structure changes from separate to marital. Another would be the growth of the inheritance. I had a case recently where it was an inherited IRA and also inherited brokerage assets. What we ended up doing was we opened a separate brokerage account so any of the growth that would be or might be considered marital would be placed into another account so as not to commingle those funds. So that's what we see.
You stress that disclosure is always the main focus in your cases. However, why does disclosure take on such significance in high net worth cases?
Disclosure is often required. In the beginning of a divorce, you have financial statements that are required. And of course, much of the information can be gathered through discovery. We find often that some of these assets are either undisclosed or undervalued. And the importance there is to review those documents that are provided, take a deeper look to gain insight, say, as I mentioned before, the tax returns. And we also find that the credibility, if we have assets that are not disclosed or underdisclosed, when that party is sitting in a courtroom, their credibility factor is significantly diminished.
Verilyn, how often are forensics employed in divorce cases? And how do you go about uncovering assets that might be undisclosed or underdisclosed?
As I had said before, we have complex tax returns that we're reviewing. Oftentimes, under the various schedule, we can uncover the ownership of property, other types of assets that may be undisclosed. We often will do significant research where even in public information, we're even going and looking at stock market quotes, what the value of a stock portfolio would be in today's dollars based on growth of that particular asset. We had talked before about the alternative minimum tax. That's also seen on the tax return that would indicate to us significant assets. And if we find that they're not disclosed in a financial document that is required by the court, why then we can go ahead and expound upon that and uncover those other assets. And finally, you know, you take a look at a W-2. In the simplest forms on the W-2, it would show the employer and employee contributions, say, to a 401k plan. That's where we can interpolate values and come up with a growth number of that 401k, for example.
What about marital lifestyle? Does that play a role in the division of assets or perhaps the determination of alimony or child support?
Yes, you know, marital lifestyle is an important consideration. And I often ask, how much is enough? You know, we're taking one style of a standard of living that is affordable under one household and then dividing that. And so it's difficult often, even with significant cash flow, to maintain that standard of living, you know, for both parties. We often have to take a look at the discretionary expenses and bring both parties, I like to say, to a sense of reasonableness. Can you still afford the nanny? You know, can you still afford the vacation home? Can you still afford to take the summer long journey, you know, overseas? So in any case, that's what we normally see.
Many high net worth clients come from families with significant wealth. How common are prenuptial agreements in these kinds of marriages, and how well do they really hold up in court?
That's also a very good question. You know, we find that under a prenuptial agreement, you know, that's entered to before the marriage, and oftentimes it involves both parties being involved. And a prenuptial agreement that is written prior to a marriage, as you move forward and accumulate significant assets, they can also be deemed unfair. They're generally considered for one individual, and sometimes the cards are stacked on the side of one individual. So they can lack equality in the consideration. In terms of how does it hold up in court, we have seen that the early prenuptial agreement does not or is not consistent with the value of the assets today. We find that many of them can be broken just for that reason, particularly in an equitable distribution state, or perhaps one party had better advice, or that party's attorney may have been the one that would have drafted that document. Sometimes if they have moved to other states, there may be a difference in terms of what would be covered and the validity of that prenuptial agreement. One of the alternatives that we sometimes use would be an asset protection trust. This is typically used to not dilute any type of family wealth in terms of the divorce. What happens often is that type of asset protection trust could be as simple as maintaining separate accounts, or it could be as easy as even having offshore accounts to maintain some of that separate property. And, you know, we look at the cost of a prenuptial, for example. You know, a simple prenuptial agreement can be anywhere from, say, $2,500 to $50,000, depending on the complexity and the amount of negotiation that goes into it, where an asset protection plan for an individual can be done at a much less expensive cost, typically from $1,500 to $18,000. But that's where we find that most parties are going to is the asset protection trust. Those typically will hold up better in court. And finally, I need to get back to the prenuptial agreement. If a party is moved, you know, you have various state laws, and they typically may not be consistent. So that's where we find a problem with the prenuptials, and they often can be broken based on those factors.
If the couple didn't have a prenup, is there anything that can be done to protect the finances if divorce is on the horizon?
It would be the same thing as we just discussed, and that would be to set up various trusts, one being the asset protection trust, and that could protect the family's finances in a much more substantial and comprehensive way.
As you mentioned earlier, many high net worth clients have an ownership interest in a family or a closely held business. If a non-family spouse becomes employed in a closely held business, what might be some of the problems that might occur if the marriage breaks down?
Some of those problems might be the need for that spouse to be involved in the business. Perhaps that person becomes a key person. Perhaps there may be benefits offered to that individual that may be in the form of deferred compensation plans and that sort of thing. When we see families with a spouse employee, of course, we're looking to preserve the assets of the business. We look at the transfer of stock, for example, and often a method that's employed is a shareholder trust agreement. And what that does is it will prevent stock being given to an individual, whether it be the husband or the wife, until other agreements are in place, for example, a prenuptial agreement. Those are the items that we see often. But again, we don't see often enough. A wealthy family has to preserve those assets, and the senior stockholders come into play. And the family is typically more involved in trying to preserve those assets from a spouse that may enter the family business.
We're always interested in real life examples. Of course, without breaching any confidentiality, can you tell us about a few of the high net worth clients that you've counseled, how you came to an equitable division of marital assets and determine alimony?
You know, some of those can be pretty tough. I once had a client, and of course, and I was involved in the same type of business that he had. It was a business that was worth $12 million. And of course, we had to do a lot of forensics in this. We had to value that business. And fortunately, we were able to do so quite easily. What we had found in this case was the disparagement of assets. We found that this husband who owned the business had hired additional employees. He had given funds to children of a previous marriage. And therefore, again, it was the forensics and uncovering the assets. And then on the other side, we had the spouse that was looking for a significant amount of alimony. And in that case, we had to bring her to a conclusion of what was the need. And we derived the alimony and the child support based on that need, as well as what the future impact would be for the children. For example, college educations, we built all of that into the scenario. And at the end of the day, it ended up to where the husband had to sell off a chunk of his assets to a partner so that he could receive the money, because it ended up in a property settlement agreement. Therefore, a very good situation for the wife in this case, as we had a tax-free transfer of assets. So that worked out very, very well for our clients. We also had one recently where the income was quite high. There were assets, but of course, you would think in this case that the retirement plans would be much larger than they were. We didn't have to do much forensics because it was pretty clear that this couple had lived well beyond their means. And they have a marital home that's underwater that they can't sell. And the husband, who is a doctor in our town, is still paying for all of the expenses associated with the house. So at this time, what they're doing is just continuing to share the joint bank account. However, what will happen in this case will be a significant amount of alimony, but based on what the numbers look like after the marital home is sold. We used a secondary loan for the husband to take so that he could pay off the balance so as to avoid any kind of a short sale or some sort of a foreclosure on the property. And in terms of the alimony, the wife had lived a significant lifestyle, and of course, her numbers were in the $15,000 to $18,000 range. When we questioned her as to what she would like her future to be and what she thought it would look like, everything pretty much changed in that number, again, bringing her to a sense of reasonableness and, of course, to a number that the husband could afford. And uncovering those discretionary expenses, for example, we were able to drop the alimony need to about $11,000 a month, which, of course, allowed the husband to be placed in a tax bracket where he could readily afford that higher level of alimony at the $11,000 versus what her actual need was at about $8,000 to $9,000 a month. So those would be some examples of where some of our cases with high net worth clients have fallen. In addition, we look at a particular case where the wife had been home for 33 years, you know, raised the children. She had very little experience out in the workforce, and she needed to go back to school to be rehabilitated. And I really don't like that word, you know, rehabilitated. But she needed to have some training so that she could enter the workforce and make some sort of income, not substantial, but that would be enough so that she could get by with her alimony. So with that, she also didn't have the opportunity to accumulate significant retirement assets. So in this case, what we did was we knew the husband would continue to accumulate those assets. He was in his 40s. And so what we ended up doing was getting a trade-off where she actually received 72% of the retirement assets. And we invested those funds for her in safe, secure investments consistent with her risk tolerance. And both of them are going to be off to a fairly bright financial future. So those are some of the cases that we've worked with recently.
Should a high net worth client considering divorce hire an experienced financial professional before hiring an attorney? And if so, why?
Absolutely. You know, when we are involved in a case, many times lawyers will come to us and say, we have these items that we cannot solve. You know, can you help us solve them? And those are after the fact. You know, we find, of course, lawyers are not financial professionals. You know, they do not have the securities licenses. They're not typically a CFP, and they're not trained in the division of marital property, particularly high complex types of situations. On the other side, a CDFA or a financial planner is not a lawyer. You know, in our capacity, we can give legal information, but we can't give legal advice. So what we'll do, a client typically will come directly to us and retain us, even if they do have a lawyer, or a lawyer will come to us and retain us. And the reason is that we can get the process started, we can uncover the assets, we can put together a number of different analyses and come up with a financial settlement so as to give the lawyers every opportunity to achieve the best settlement for their clients. So we prepackage, we save a lot of time, and we pretty much can come down to the meat of the financial matter and try to settle the case. And, of course, we're working with definitive numbers, you know, something that is quantitative. And, therefore, you have very little dispute of what a property settlement can be that is equitable and one that can be negotiated well. And actually, for the purpose to help each one of the parties involved in the divorce.
Marilyn, having worked with many different lawyers with different levels of skills and experience, what would be your recommendation for a high net worth client seeking legal representation?
Our recommendation typically is to find a lawyer who is experienced in the financial areas, those that would understand closely held family businesses, those that would understand, you know, investment accounts, and those that would have their own team, if you will, that they can draw upon in order to help us uncover those assets that might be undisclosed, as well as to work with our professionals to come to a suitable settlement without having the attorney that is bent on a fight. We like to work with attorneys who work in the spirit of negotiated settlement, those that are willing to come to a conclusion without having a large court battle. I mean, after all, we have significant assets, and we have not only complex assets, but many different types of assets. That lawyer has to be well-versed in the financial area. That makes our conversation more productive. And, of course, again, we come to a negotiated settlement that is going to preserve assets that will not be spent in a courtroom. And, of course, we all know that when it comes to determining which and what assets, we don't want someone in a black robe deciding on how those assets are going to be divided. So a lawyer, I would say, that we would use would be one who is highly experienced in the financial area.
My guest today has been Verilyn Morris, a certified divorce financial analyst with offices in Frederick, Maryland. Verilyn owns three companies related to divorce and finance: Divorce Financial Solutions, Maryland Quadro, and Potomac Financial, which enables her to provide a suite of services to her divorcing clients. For more information about Verilyn and her firm, please visit her website at www.divorcefinancialsolutions.org.